Joseph Campbell in conversation with Michael Toms. New Dimensions and our quarter-hour New Dimensions Cafe programs are now available worldwide as podcasts. You can find them at the iTunes Store and on many podcast sites and mobile apps. You can also find our podcasts and much more on our website, newdimensions.org.
I'm here with Pam Houston. She's just a beautiful, beautiful writer. I just recommend her writing so much. And her book that we're talking about right now is called Deep Creek, Finding Hope in the High Country. And Pam, we've just talked a little bit about your growing up and being rather unsupervised in so many ways from some parents who didn't particularly want children in their life and you as their daughter. So you have found your way. You have found your way. Actually, now you're in your 30s. I'm bringing the listeners into where we are now in your 30s, and you've bought this ranch in Colorado. You've been working it. You have animals. You have friends. You're writing. You're going off and teaching writing. And now it's been some years. You're a little better at being a rancher,
right?
With a little help from your friends, of course, with a lot of help from your friends. And you devote a part of your book to just a devastating wildfire. And I just want to say, those of us who live west of the Rockies, this is a reality for us, right? And has been for many years. This is no joke.
Right.
This is big time. I mean, I took time to write out all the fires that have happened in Northern California in just the last 4 years. The acres and acres. So, I mean, this is big time. So you experienced this firsthand right there on the ranch, a wildfire, and you describe that. And you point out that some of this is caused by our own human hands, that we've exacerbated, that we put wildfires on steroids, as you say, because of our own human participation. So please talk a bit about that.
Well, when I started writing the book, I really wanted it to be about the ranch, and I wondered if I could write it exclusively about the ranch, and I tried. At one point, my agent said, "Isn't this the book where you really talk about what happened to you as a kid?" And she was right. You know, the ranch had to be a sanctuary for the childhood, you know, and my search for home in the absence of it previously, it made the book make sense. The other thing that was happening the whole time I was writing this book, which is basically over the last 7 years, is, you know, the imminence of the climate catastrophe that we're in has become more and more and more, undeniable. And we see, one way we see that here in the West is with fire. I mean, we live in a post-fire landscape now, you know, and just hundreds of thousands of acres. If you look at the whole American West and the Canadian West, I mean, it's unthinkable the amount of acres that have burned. And of course, that's climate related in certain ways. My fire was spruce, mostly spruce pine forest. And those fires do burn historically very big every 200 years. But of course, the intensity of the fire was increased by the beetle kill, which is related to the climate. You know, we're in dire straits, you know, and you don't have to have your finger on the pulse of science to know that. It's 10 degrees hotter on average where I live than it was when I moved there 25 years ago. And of course, what I realized over the course of writing the book, you know, every book teaches you something you didn't know about yourself. And I didn't see until I got it on the page together, the connection between, you know, what I'm asking of the reader, which is to love the natural world, to continue to love the natural world, even though loving it means holding a sadness right there next to the love that we have really spent this planet, that the earth is dying at our hands. And that's a deep sadness. And when you're out in nature and you see the ways it's changed, or you see the effects of climate change, or even when you just see the beauty and think, oh, this is going to be steamrolled, you know, Trump's coming in here with his oil barons. Like you can't love the natural world anymore without holding that sadness right next to it, that we're in trouble. And, we're on the verge of spending our last chips.
What you're saying is to not turn away from witnessing that.
Right.
Both the beauty and the devastation, to not turn our backs on it, and even though it's hard.
Well, that seems to me the challenge of right now. I mean, so much about our political situation right now is trying to get people to say yes or no, them or us. And to me, it's all about the and. It's all about, you know, yes, this is deeply sad that our forests are burning. Yes, our forests are still beautiful. And even in post-burn, they become beautiful again because of nature's urge to renew itself. And I mean, there's so much to love out there still, and we have to keep loving it. We have to keep loving it actively, because if we just turn to cities or turn to our screens, we're just going to eat it up even faster. But what I saw when I wrote the book was the relationship between that and my own damage that I incurred as a child, and, you know, how the course of my life I've had to learn to love myself anyway. I talk about it as leaving it. Like, do you leave the dog off at the door of the vet and just let the vet give the dog the shot that puts her down? Or do we sit there with the earth and pet her ears, you know, as she dies? And I'm not a scientist. I don't know what we might do now to prolong our time on Earth, or if the best thing for the Earth would be for it to shake its most determined parasite off her back and go about its business without us. I don't know, you know, but I do know that I have learned to love myself in spite of the damage that was, you know, perpetrated on me as a child. And now I feel it's my job to love the earth in spite of the way her beauty is diminished in some cases.
Now, there's something that you wrote, and I wanted to ask you what you meant by this phrase. And it was when you were saying something about how Mother Nature bats last, mm-hmm. you know. And here's what you wrote. You said, seeing her power up close like this makes me believe she may find a way to survive, but still, what did you mean by that?
Just that seeing the fire out my bedroom window, I watched the fire eat up about 7 miles of a mountainside in a couple of hours. You know, flames shooting hundreds of feet in the air. Mother Nature is ferocious, and what she's trying to do up there is clean out those dead trees. We've got hundreds of thousands of acres of beetle-killed spruce on the mountainside, and that's not a healthy forest. So she sends some lightning down, burns that forest to the ground, new aspens come in, new life comes in, fireweed. You know, that's Mother Nature cleansing that forest. And that's a beautiful thing and very impressive. And there are scientists who say we could take the earth all the way down to the microbes and she would still recover. And there's another part in the book where I talk to a environmental scientist who says, oh yeah, the future of the earth looks very grim in the 100-year frame, but in the 500-year frame, it looks pretty good. He says, there won't be hardly any people here, but the ones who are here will have learned a lot. And I do think that's a form of hope. I mean, obviously it will create massive suffering for humans and creatures. But, you know, we've gotten ourselves into this mess, and I'm not a scientist. I don't know how to fix it. What the interesting question to me is how we're going to be, how we're going to act now. Like, are we going to love the earth? Are we going to put our money and our time into protecting what's left? Or if it's even too late for that, are we going to sing? Are we going to sit by our bedside? Like, aren't we more interesting people if we do, as opposed to just turning our backs and saying, oh, yeah, that was beautiful once, but now I'm just going to go to the mall.
You write also, like, there are a lot of people who, I think you say something like 80% of the population has never seen the Milky Way.
Right. Live in a place where they can't see.
They can't see it. I mean, because of all the light pollution. And also that teaching writing in the way that you do, there would be people who wouldn't understand any reference about elk or bristlecone pine or whatever.
Right.
They don't understand. I'm thinking that the Oxford Dictionary, the youth dictionary, has actually they've dropped some words like bristlecone pine, or like, I mean, just these nature terms that you and I have grown up with,
right,
have been dropped from the dictionary and put in things that are kind of technological things, that like spam or something, what spam means. And it doesn't mean the thing that you eat that's
out of a can.
Out of a can.
That Monty Python.
Yeah. So there we are. Just how do we encourage each other to find that and befriend that tree that's grows close to us? Mm-hmm. Maybe it's outside our apartment on the sidewalk,
right.
You know,
yeah,
or something.
Right.
I mean, I remember when my mother was dying and she was living with me and with her dying, and I was standing waiting for a bus, and there was a bush there, just this big old scraggly bush, and I just turned to it and I buried my face, mm-hmm, in this bush, and I just felt this living being, right, taking my tears.
Right.
I was bereft and the bush helped me.
Right.
And I remember that moment as very precious.
Sure. I mean, it's only our culture that doesn't believe in that. Most cultures believe you could give your sorrow to a tree and the tree would hold it. You know, we've gotten so far away from that, but that's a real thing. I mean, I believe it's a real thing.
Well, you've experienced it.
Right.
You've experienced it. And that's what you talk about when you say, and in my introduction and in your book, the earth has held you. This ranch that you live on has held you.
Right.
It literally.
Literally.
Yeah.
And it's it has mothered me. It grew me up. It taught me responsibility. It taught me consistency.
I was going to say consistency. We'll talk about that in just one moment. I'm here with Pam Houston. She is the author of Deep Creek, Finding Hope in the High Country. And Pam also is a great writer and teaches writing. She teaches at University of California, Davis, near Sacramento, California. And she teaches writing all over the world, actually. So check out her website, pamhouston.net. Or you can get there through the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You're listening to New Dimensions.
Thank you.
I'm here with Pam Houston. She's a wonderful writer of many books and teaches writing. And her newest book, or the one that we're talking about this week, is Deep Creek, Finding Hope in the High Country. And I would love to talk about your writing practice. And you make the statement that your writing rises more often from tactile experience than it does from any writing theory that you get from a book. So let's talk about writing and just the act of writing.
Sure. My method, which I teach, though not exclusively, I'm happy to meet anybody's work wherever it is. But what I do as a writer, and what I've always done, is when I'm out in the world, the natural world or not, the urban world, any world I find myself in, I try to pay really strict attention with all my senses. And I'm waiting in that space for something to do what I call glimmer at me, something that's going to suggest itself to me as a metaphor. But I don't think about what the metaphor means. You know, I'm really just recording noteworthy, and when I say noteworthy, I mean only to me, experience. So that could be just the way the light's reflecting off the surface of the river. It could be a conversation overheard at the grocery store. It could be having the great good fortune of seeing 800 narwhal in the Eastern Canadian Arctic on their migration. I guess that would be a glimmer for anyone. But what I'm waiting for is to feel this feeling of resonance. It's actually a physical feeling. It's a vibrational, really. And what that vibration means is that thing in the outside world is going to help me unlock some internal thing, some part of my story. Or it could just be because it's so cool, I can't not write about it, like the narwhal. and then I just have all these pieces of the physical world that I feel like I've literally sort of scooped up and dropped on the page in language. And then I see how they go together. Like which ones want to come out and play, which ones feel hot. And when I have some writing time, I will literally bring them together. So that's how I write everything I write, which means what I don't do is I don't say, oh, I have an idea for a character, or I want to tell a story about. I don't do that. I mean, with The Ranch, I decided I wanted to commit a book to my 25-year relationship to this ranch, but I still didn't do anything other than just say, okay, what are the glimmers from the ranch? You know, there was that time I fed the horses during the blizzard. There was that time the elk calf got abandoned by our mother on the property. There's the time, you know, and so I just start writing those pieces and then see how they might work together.
I love that. I love that because it's the way I write. I take notes. And I keep this kind of little notebook that it says, oh, I really want to flesh this one out because I saw it out of the corner of my eye.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And it attracted my attention.
Right, exactly.
And why did it attract my attention? And then I kind of write out from that.
Mm-hmm. Me too.
and it's so deeply satisfying because it takes us into the world in a different way,
right?
Wouldn't you say? Can you describe that?
I can. to me, it's much more intuitive. I'm much more in my intuitive brain when I notice those things and when I write them down. Because what I'm trying to avoid early in the writing is my analytical brain taking over. I think our analytical brains are big fat liars, and I don't want to overdetermine the meaning of any of these things. So when I'm actually recording them, like I write them down, and I think, get in, get out, you know, write them down, let them sit on the page, and then just wait till you have time to mess with it, rather than trying to manipulate it so that it fits with something else I'm writing, or write all the way to its meaning. You know, I'm not interested in knowing its meaning. In fact, the longer that I can not know its meaning, the better. And I'm just interested in getting it down, believing in that vibrational feeling that it was meaningful, and then seeing what other ones I can pair it with. But I to me, it's like a way to do an end around my analytical brain and to stay in the intuitive art-making place as long as possible. eventually, you know, once there's a draft, I have to start engaging my analytical brain more, not necessarily to find out what something means, but to, you know, just to think about, oh, well, the first 20 pages of this is full of birds and then birds fell out of it altogether. Like just, you know, just some cleanup or some, you know, seeing themes. And, you know, I'm not against my analytical brain. I have a good one and I'm glad it's there, but I try to keep it out of the process as long as I can.
I can remember the first piece I ever wrote and I really aspired to be a writer. It's something that I really wanted to do well. And I wrote my first piece about a horse. And I turned it over to two people, one who was a copy editor, and the other was a teammate in New Dimensions who was an English major. And I gave it to Phil, and Phil got back to me, and he said to me, "This is a mess." And my heart just fell. And he said, "But I want to tell you, I'm jealous." I said, "What?" And he said, "Yeah, because," he said, "everything about this can be fixed. You know, the grammar, the spelling, the everything, it can all be fixed. But you're just able to write down that stream of consciousness and you really connect with it in a visceral way." He said, "As an English major, I can't put anything on the paper unless it's perfect." Perfect grammar, perfect this, perfect, and that analytical mind. Since then, he's been able to abandon that and lighten up. But in that moment, it's kind of what you're talking about.
Right. Well, any way I can free my mind or free my intuition to speak through the metaphor, because that's where it speaks the best. I always say, I think the metaphor always knows more than I do. And so, you know, the narwhal knows more than I do, or the light on the surface of the river does, you know, that impulse toward a thing in the physical world is going to be more emotionally intelligent than I am. If I am trying to, like I said, make it fit a certain way or make it do a certain thing, I want to try to keep that out of the process as long as I can. And I find that if I put, you know, several different of these glimmers together, you know, they distill and the meaning, you know, kind of oozes up out of them. And to me, that's the ideal writing situation, as opposed to me saying, well, I want to mean this thing, so I'm going to go out and find the metaphor that means it. Like, that's not going to make good work for me.
So I'm amazed, Pam, how someone, and this is where I am right now in mine, I mean, the book that I did was a book of essays.
Uh-huh.
And that's a very different kettle of fish because you have all these separate, maybe they can be in different categories, but to do a whole book like Deep Creek that has a kind of trajectory from, it goes back and forth. It goes to your childhood and then it goes into the here and now. It does go back and forth, but still, it's this whole story that's held together. I find that amazing. How do you do that? How do you do a whole book that has a beginning, a middle, and an end?
Not in order. I mean, one thing I do is I try to find the form. And in this book, I knew the form had something to do with a calendar or an almanac. And the short pieces, there's 12 of them, like the 12 months that fall between the other chapters, they're really creating the spine of the book so that the longer chapters can wind around in time and in subject matter. But those 12 Ranch Almanac pieces, they're in the order of the calendar. And I had to work really hard to get them in the order of the calendar because of like who you get introduced to and which animals I have when and all that. So I had to really maneuver them to get them in the right place. In fact, I had one called the Perseids about the Perseid meteor shower, and I couldn't get it in August where it belonged. So I had to change it to the Leonids and rewrite it. I had to change my meteor shower so I could keep the order of the calendar right. So for me, that's how. Like, there's always some kind of structure that holds it together. My last book, Contents May Have Shifted, I think of that book as a 12-sided Rubik's Cube, which is called a dodecahedron. Like, that geometry was important to me as a kid, and I like to understand the geometry of every book. And those are kind of my parameters. That's how I hold the whole thing together, even when I get really lost in it, even when I can't keep it organized and I can't keep it in order. And I think that's actually very good time. That's very good writing time when you're in despair and you think, oh, I've just lost it. I can't make sense of any of this. It's too big. It's gotten out of control. I'll never get it back. Those, I think, are sometimes the best, you know, the times of writing that yields the best results, even though they're terrifying and full of despair.
So did you see yourself as a writer early on, as a teenager or anything? Was that something you aspired to? Or
yeah, I mean, again, I was an only child. My parents were drunk. You know, I spent a lot of time reading and writing, and I took, you know, the creative writing classes that were offered at my high school. So I was on a trajectory, even though I didn't always know it for sure. At one point, I thought I was going to be a marine biologist, like every girl, like me, you know. Yeah. At one point, I thought I was going to be a park ranger. But in general, writing was always a thing.
Well, we could just talk about so much more. And I just want to thank you so much, Pam, for being with us today on New Dimensions.
Oh, thank you, Justine. I had a really good time.
I did, too. I have been here with Pam Houston. She is the author of Deep Creek, Finding Hope in the High Country. And if you want to know more about her writing workshops and also her other books, please go to her website, pamhouston.net. Or you can give there through the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You've been listening to New Dimensions. This is program number 3669.
New Dimensions Radio has been making a difference on our planet since 1973, thanks to the generosity of our listeners. You too can help make a difference with a tax-deductible donation or membership. Please visit our website, newdimensions.org, and just click the donate button. You can also subscribe to our free weekly podcasts and find over 1,000 hours of audio dialogues in our searchable archive. New Dimensions is produced by New Dimensions Radio in Santa Rosa, California, USA. Our executive producer is Justine Willis-Toms. Our post-production editor is Lou Judson. For over 4 decades, New Dimensions has been producing weekly conversations at the leading edge. We sincerely thank all of you who have supported us by being members of Friends of New Dimensions, as well as members of our affiliate stations. My name is Dan Drayson. On behalf of everyone at New Dimensions, whose endeavors make this program possible, I'm wishing you well. New Dimensions Radio is an independent producer supported by listener contributions. To find out more about the program you've just heard, to subscribe to our free weekly newsletter and our New Dimensions and New Dimensions Cafe podcasts, and to access thousands of other programs in the New Dimensions archive, please visit our website, newdimensions.org. That's newdimensions.org. Or call us at 707-468-5215. That's 707-468-5215. Please join us next time as we explore New Dimensions. New Dimensions is brought to you by Friends of New Dimensions membership support and by Larson Publications, publisher of the book An Open Life, Joseph Campbell in Conversation with Michael Toms. New Dimensions and our quarter-hour New Dimensions Cafe programs are now available worldwide as podcasts. You can find them at the iTunes Store and on many podcast sites and mobile apps. You can also find our podcasts and much more on our website, newdimensions.org. Each week, New Dimensions explores the social, political, scientific, environmental, and spiritual frontiers with some of today's foremost social innovators, thinkers, scientists, and creative artists.
I'm Jean Shinoda Bolen, MD, author of Ever Widening Circles and Mystical Moments.
You can deny all the things I've seen, all the things I've discovered, but not for much longer, because too many others know what's happening out there.
I want to believe. Hi, this is David Duchovny, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby.
This is